Holy God, you have shown yourself to your children. You have called out from among those a community to be faithful to your name and to walk in your ways. Help us, Lord, to know what it means to live into your kingdom according to your reign, to be willing to share our gifts with one another, and to care for your creation so that all people and all things may prosper. Through Christ our Lord. Amen. Amen. Okay, today we are going to be looking in particular at the question of consequences of moral actions, and in that sense be looking at utilitarianism, the school of utilitarianism. Yesterday we looked at what's known as deontological ethics, the most famous representative being Immanuel Kant. And we're going to follow a similar format. I've got some dilemmas here that I'm going to pass out that I want people to consider. We'll look at those and discuss them. Then I will give some background about utilitarianism. And then I'd like to add another part to this, and that would be to see if we ourselves can come up with any kinds of utilitarian rules that might satisfy these dilemmas, or for that matter, Kantian rules that might satisfy these dilemmas that we're talking about, if we have enough time. We may not, and you may just have to go away yourself working on those, but it's kind of fun to see if you can do that. I'm going to give these to Dick, and I'm going to give this to Susan. Actually, maybe I'll give some to Ed, too. We may have to share, I don't know for sure. I do have some bibliography that are left. This is just if you get interested, and my hope is that you will, because there's no possible way that we can deal with all the complexities of making moral decisions and moral philosophy and moral theology in just 5 days. So I've made a list of texts, starting with sort of the easiest to the more technical. And all these have great bibliographies and stuff in them, and you can go from those to other things if you really decide you want to do more. Okay, today, let's look at dilemma number 8 on the first front side of your page. On a local Indian reservation, whites have been living for years on land which they bought thinking it not to be Indian land. Now it turns out that the land was illegally taken from the tribe years ago. How do you resolve this issue?
Well, who sold it to you?
Years ago, it was sold to them, some of it by Indians themselves, and others by the government and by other people who thought the land, mistakenly, when they laid it out, was their land. This actually is a real dilemma in the state of Minnesota.
First, we have a study on it that costs $100 million or something.
So you would suggest a study, Phyllis?
No, I'm not suggesting it. That's the way it usually.
That's the way it usually works. Okay.
And have a study for 3 years.
Yes.
How does it work out? Since I've not been involved, to go to the Indians and offer to rent it from at a reasonable rate, and it's so your house is theirs. I mean, it's their land. But does this have any effect to take this?
Okay, so what Margaret is suggesting here is a compromise would be for the people who now find themselves after several generations living on land that turns out to be really part of the reservation land, that they could go to the tribal council and offer, in a sense, to lease the land from the Indians, which would entail, it would seem to me, then giving up title of the land back to the tribe. Even though you own that land now and you paid for that land, you're giving that land back to the tribe and now you're going to lease it from them.
It's a pretty cloudy title, though, if their land really belongs to them, even though you didn't know it when you bought it.
How is this a moral dilemma and not just a legal dilemma?
Well, in the question, I suppose, of justice, what is what is morally right in terms of distribution of shares, bearing of burdens, the sharing of consequences, the benefits of this.
But if we weren't dealing with an Indian reservation here, we were dealing with transactions between just buyers, in effect, real estate law is very clear. The title, if title truly didn't pass, it didn't pass under the legal principle of buyer beware.
Right. What Dick is pointing out is that there is a whole body of law here, and it raises another issue. And this gets us ahead, in a sense, to Saturday, but Robert Nozick, who is a moral philosopher, who's in a sense a person who believes in the minimal state and believes that the primary concern of ethics and social philosophy should be in fair transactions, honest and open transactions, and then let it fall where it may. People have the freedom to do this. But in this case, if somebody bought something which was not theirs, it gets a little complicated, because if they were told that the title cleared several generations ago and it's passed on to people, and now it turns out that it isn't, then it gets to be a question as to whether or not that is, in a sense, a fair and honest transaction. And then the question comes, of course, we've got the question of restitution here, or retributive justice,
right,
going on here. So those are definitely important issues. Jan?
Is this only a personal consideration? Isn't it really a national or a governmental consideration? And haven't we illegally taken a great deal of land from the Native Americans, if you want to look at it that way? And isn't this the same thing that is happening today in Israel and the occupied territories, where the right to return is being pursued by some Palestinians? Now, according to Arafat, they're willing to give that up and seek compensation instead of the right to return to land. But this happens all over the world, and the nation that conquers the other group, whether it be national or tribal, assumes that through war or through power, they have a right to that land. So aren't we fundamentally questioning that inherited right to, through war, take the lands, the territories, okay, of another people?
Okay, let's deal with that. How would all of that then relate to these several families on that particular piece of land that turns out now to be reservation land? How would this larger historical fact relate to that group? How would that entail upon this particular dilemma? I mean, here we've got a tribal council, and here we've got a group of families.
If I were one of the white people living on the land, and I discovered that it were Indian land.
You were probably told that it was Indian land.
All right. I think that, you know, I would have to pursue governmental channels and tribal council channels to decide what should be the case, because it seems to me like it might be one of these representative cases that might go all the way to the Supreme Court, for that matter.
Okay.
Now, I would personally want to return that land to the Native Americans, but how about all the other land that's being occupied? I mean, I think...
Okay, so why, in a sense, why should I...
Yeah.
Why do I have to bear an unfair burden if, in this particular case, I'm being asked to do this when there are lots of other people living on Indian land illegally, too?
Right.
Wouldn't it be more fair if everybody likewise were forced to do this, or required to do it in some way?
Whether the land were to be returned, or if there was some sort of compensation, such as the rental fees that Margaret was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I think an important question would be, is the land itself important? Like, the Black Hills of South Dakota is sacred land to the Lakotas, and so is it that land that's important to them? And in that case, they really need the land and not just compensation for the land. Or will the Native peoples accept compensation and not necessarily the land back? That would be an important mm-hmm. issue to look at.
So the character of the land becomes important too. Well, how about the issue of, you know, these families have been living on this land for a long time. They've been very productive, far more productive in our terms than the Native Americans. I mean, they've produced lots of things. They've increased the economy in the area. They've even provided jobs for some of the Native Americans. I mean, they're really part of the backbone of what little economy there is up there. They're doing a lot of good in the community.
That's precisely the argument that the Israeli authorities are using to maintain their right to the land in Israel, or what was once Palestine, that they made the desert bloom, you know, mm-hmm. and that's reason enough mm-hmm. to
right.
Can I take your land if I'll use it better then?
Well, that's the argument.
Yeah,
it's
I know.
Not my
yeah.
argument.
No, I mean, just you between yeah. you and me now, Pam. Uh-huh. I don't think you'd agree to that.
Yet. Absolutely not. I don't care.
I don't
if
think
your
the Indians should
more
either.
More fertile than mine, you know.
Well, yeah, land. It's a value judgment.
Yeah.
They may think that land is fairly productive. I mean, like another instance is we think the only use for the Arctic Circle is to pump oil out of it. But there's just an inherent value of wildlife and tundra that is very frat, you know what I mean?
Yes, I do.
It's whose value system okay. are we using to assess land?
Who decides what counts as valuable? Yeah.
Then you have a fundamental problem. That's why this is a moral dilemma. You know, and I'll answer my own first question, because you are dealing with an Indian reservation, and fundamentally the Indian doesn't believe that land is owned in the first place.
Right.
And it is a reservation which we deeded their own land back to them, and usually got very much the best of the deal. And you're dealing with their position is you are dealing with a nation and a national ownership when you deal with reservation land. And this is very true. And the closest one to us, the Yakima Reservation, where they're trying to get back the land that they legally sold, not illegally, legally sold to whites. They would like to reclaim most of their reservation and then operate as if it's a nation and jointly owned lands. So that's where the moral dilemma really gets complex. You're not dealing with the simple transactions of you and I.
So if you get, Dick's brought up another problem, because there have been cases where members of the tribe have illegally sold the land to whites, you know, years and years ago,
right.
even though, you know, they shouldn't have done that, and then it's passed on for several generations, yeah. and now you get the problem internally in the tribe itself. How do you deal with that? You know, who bears the burden in the tribe? The descendants of that family, yeah. or does the tribe bear it? How do you pay restitution to these people who, in a sense, only legally bought the land? It wasn't truly legally, if we're getting at the facts, because technically they didn't have the right to sell that land, but that didn't seem to make a whole lot of difference years ago. Yes, Marjorie.
Well, I mean, as I understand it, and I'm not super keen on this, but I have heard some of the Yakima and Tahpa Nation Indians speak, it partly was the way the government changed things, that at some time they came through and they sort of said, we're going to divide this up, the number of people here, and you get each
yes.
share, so that the government made the rules so that at that particular time it was legal, but it was really sort of uninformed consent that the Indians' values and education and whatnot were not really, they were really being exploited and taken advantage of, and having the white man's values put onto them at the time when the sales took.
The whole issue of paternalism in the past, feeling that exactly. we knew better how to help the Indians deal with their land, and so we sort of forced
much
it on
of that
them.
Done in the name of religion.
Yes.
Which is why so many of them are named Moses. And there's just a wonderful little tale at the center for the Yakimas about Moses Jim, and he tells about what the white missionaries did for the Indian in rather cynical terms, but accurate.
Yeah.
And that's part of the cloud on this issue, is that we not only put them on a reservation, but did exactly what you said, is that we also told them, now you must learn to live like the white man, because it's a better way to live. And that's where the subdivision of the lands, which is was probably, you know, at least quasi-legally done, so it's not quite a clouded title. And so then the morality of this dilemma really comes into it, at least.
We don't want to bring up our former president and his famous remark in Moscow about American Indians. We'll just sort of leave that as an aside here. Let's move on to dilemma number 9, which deals perhaps with more of us. It's a little closer to home. People near the airport, in your town, city, whatever, are complaining about the increase in traffic and noise at the airport. They say it lowers their quality of life and the value of their homes. They want some traffic redirected over other neighborhoods. One of the proposed neighborhoods is yours. At the same time, the Airport Commission is talking about building another runway to accommodate increased traffic at the airport. How do you resolve this issue? Margaret.
Well, I've lived with one of those, and I have noticed that they tend to put airports way out in the boonies to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens? Everybody moves that way. And then when they get there, they do this crying about what's going on. And so I have no sympathy for those people.
Okay.
They don't put the airport in the middle of a housing development. I mean, that would be amazing.
Okay. So, again, we're getting at facts. If the airport were placed outside of town, and there were no homes around, and people then, of their own volition, chose to move near the airport...
Cheap land.
Then the problem is something that the people themselves bear. What happens if, when they moved out there, it was a new airport, there wasn't much traffic, wasn't too bad, now the area is developed and my goodness, the planes are going in and out all the time.
Well, what they do in Albuquerque is they can't go at certain times across the city.
Okay. Anybody else got any ideas about this? What about the suggestion to redirect the traffic? I mean, isn't it, should all the traffic just go over this one particular area? Shouldn't it be spread out a little bit around the community?
We have that dilemma in Seattle International, and they do have it spread around to some extent because of the wind and the velocity, you know, so that they don't all follow the same pattern. But essentially, depending on what the conditions of the weather are, where those patterns are. But that also was put in an area where it was not highly populated to begin with, but now the population has increased around there, and they are crying their heads out.
Yeah, a good portion of the nearest homes in SeaTac, though, were purchased by the government and removed and replaced with the golf course, presuming the golfers can live with it.
Well, unless they hit a ball real high. There's many golf places besides that one that they proposed, I agree.
Well, but, you know, what about, you know, why not run it over a part of the city that, you know, I mean, really the houses aren't worth that much anyway, and the people, you know, they're not the kind of people who are going to have a lot of power anyhow. It isn't going to affect the value of their homes so much, whereas over here there might be a wealthy neighborhood where the consequences would be more extreme on the, you know, the value of the homes and the type of people who are there. You know, why not pick out sort of the neighborhood where, you know, basically in terms of the values and stuff, the consequences be the lowest?
Well, one reason is the pure physics of, you know, what airport traffic patterns are and what your wind directions are. That, I mean, you're not entirely free. I just got through taking a class in cost-benefit analysis where they played with things like this, and one of the objections, that, I mean, they'd sit there and they'd add up general costs to society versus costs to particular people versus benefits to society. And I said, I mean, you can always make this. I mean, if you start talking about thousands of travelers who use the airport, you could always overwhelm the particular residents in the thing just by how you choose your numbers. Well, what they would do in cost benefit analysis, they would run out and they would ask people how much compensation they would be willing to accept versus how much they would be willing to pay to avoid it. And again, I sat there and objected and said, one, you have not taken into account numbers of people that you, in the rich sections of town, you have a few people willing to pay a whole lot versus many numbers of people, of the poorer people. And all my professor did was stop calling on me in class. But also the willingness to accept versus the willingness to pay. Your willingness to pay is constrained by your budget line, how much money you have, but your willingness to accept can be out here in the...
Yeah. But what's wrong with that? I mean, why not decide an issue on what promotes the greatest good for society as a whole?
Because you constantly have to protect those who don't have power in society, because the people who do have power in society write all the rules. And so they can write, they can say cost-benefit analysis and say that the cost really depends on monetary costs. Those are the most important costs. Because the people, the oppressors and the dominant people get to write the rules. If the people without power could write the rules, then the cost would be very different, you know?
But why should I respect the rights of those people who have to bear the consequences? Who says I have to do that?
Nobody. That's why not being decided on moral issues.
But I'm asking you, what's the moral reason that I should care about those people who you feel are being unjustly treated? Why should I do that? Is it just your feeling? You feel that you shouldn't do that? It just intuitively says, I don't like that? Or is there some reason that you give that says you ought to respect the rights of all people? On what basis do you make that statement?
That's a basic of our faith.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, we're all equal under God.
Okay.
And in theory, we're all equal under the law.
Okay. So there are two different things here. We've talked about in our government, the law says that all people are equal regardless. Okay. What would be the moral justification upon which the law itself was written? Is there some
property
higher
rights.
Principle
yeah.
that
property rights?
Property rights that, yeah. that each
that the whole emphasis in economics and our legal law and even the Constitution is based on establishing property rights.
Okay. I was trying to get hard there in this stuff because part of what ethics and moral philosophy is about is trying to come up with good reasons in order to put the burden of argument on the other side. It's not just enough to sort of have a gut feeling that that's wrong, because somebody else is going to have a gut feeling that it's right. And there is a whole school of moral philosophy that was begun in the 30s, which I mentioned last time, called emotivism, which has pretty much died out now, but there are a few people left, who say that's basically all morals is gut feelings. It's like aesthetics. That's bad. I feel that's bad. I feel that's good, because there are no good reasons, because there are no ways you can write moral statements that can any way be objectively at least falsify. But there's still, you know, that has been basically set aside because they realized that was, there were good arguments that set that school aside. So it's not kind of a backwater now. But the dominant concern is still, can you come up with good reasons for your position in order to convince other rational people that your principles are the right ones? And today we're looking at one set of principles, or one particular rule that has dominated Western society, and especially, as we've just noticed, questions of justice and policy for really the last 100 years, since a man named John Stuart Mill, following Jeremy Bentham, wrote two classic works on liberty and utilitarianism. Because Mill and others were unsatisfied with Kant's position, and others likewise who gave people certain moral rules, a whole sort of bag of rules that did not seem to have any way of being resolved other than sort of personal preference. They wanted a more objective way to decide the good. As you remember, last time we met, for Kant, there were sort of two forms of his categorical imperative, which admitted no exceptions and which define our actions. And they are that we should be willing to act only on those principles which we can will to be a universal law that would be acceptable by rational persons. So if we, in a given situation, decide this is what ought to be done, can we will that that become a universal law? And if we can, do we think that all, most, or really you would say overwhelmingly, rational people would accept this law? And then act on it solely on the basis of duty, not concerned about ends. No, not ends, just because it is the right thing to do is to follow that law. The second statement of that is very similar. It's about being natural law, but the third one is different, and that is that we should act always to treat people as ends and never as means only, respecting the autonomy of individuals, which comes from his philosophy about the nature of reason and the power of an individual to come to his or her own principles, and which may in some ways get to some of the things that we've been talking about here. Are people being used as means only and not as ends? It's not, you can never be used as means, but not as means only. But Mill and others had a different view. They said their system is based on basically two connected theses. An action or a practice is right when compared with any other alternative action or practice if it leads to the greatest possible balance of good consequences or to the least possible balance of bad consequences in the world as a whole. An action or a practice is right if it leads to the greatest possible balance of good consequences or to the least possible balance of bad consequences in the world as a whole. And then the concepts of duty and right are subordinated to or determined by that which maximizes the good. That which promises the best outcome determines what it is right to do. So all these consequentialist theories are really part of another system called teleological ethics, which is aiming at an end. The good determines the right, okay? Not just simply the right itself, but you're aiming at the good, and what is morally right is that which increases the good, okay? So for Mill, the principle of utility is so simple. You know, that's what I think captured everybody. Actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to produce the reverse of happiness. Pretty simple. Okay? Now it's interesting that Mill in utilitarianism does admit qualitative differences among pleasures. He doesn't just count them all equally. Since that time, there's been a drastic change because they realized, philosophers realized, that, you know, some of these problems with determining qualitative pleasures. And they now just simply talk about the satisfaction of preferences, you know, getting away from the sort of the qualitative aspect. So you get a kind of moral calculus. So we have a particular issue, and we go around the room. Let's see. For Dick, The benefit would be 9, the cost would be 2. For Marjorie, the cost would be 7, but the benefit would be 4. And for Kirsten, it would be, you know, and you look at the alternatives and you sit there and you try to measure people's desires and their satisfactions, their happiness, according to how they see it, and then you measure that against their unhappiness that would be a consequence of this. Now, Mill also was optimistic about human nature, and he thought that there was an inherent desire for unity and harmony among human beings. And so therefore, interestingly enough, in the in utilitarianism, he talks about sort of the golden rule as being the ideal for utilitarian decision making, because all decisions are to be made as if you were a disinterested, benevolent spectator. You know, you're not deciding for yourself, you're not biased toward anybody else, you just sit up there like God and remove yourself from the situation and then try to decide how everything should be distributed. From this classical statement of utilitarianism has evolved primarily two different schools of utilitarianism. One is called act utilitarianism and the other is called rule utilitarianism. Act utilitarianism is just what it says. Their principles justify particular acts. Not rules, it's just simply acts. The right action is that which has the greatest utility in the circumstances. And there are some problems with this. Some classic examples. You're in a community, times are hard, things aren't going well, there's chaos, the economy isn't working out very well. Looks like in this situation it would be best if we could somehow take this group of the people, put them in special circumstances, and ask them, in a sense, to be the slaves of the rest of people in society. So this minority would bear a pretty high cost, but the majority would be so much better off. And in a sense, then, not just the majority would be so much better off, but actually everybody would be better off, because anarchy would be removed and you know, things would happen. The trains would run on time. The economy would get going again. And we know somebody who took that idea to heart not over 50 years ago now and tried to put such a thing into practice. Another example that's used as a counterexample is that a friend who's dying asks you to take his or her money and give it to a rich uncle. And you promise to do that. Okay. But after the person dies, you realize this rich uncle doesn't need that money. So it would seem like it would be a lot better if I took that money and distributed it among people who really need it or gave it to a cause that really needed the money. Greater happiness would come from giving this money to others than giving it to the rich uncle. Therefore, it's okay for me to break the promise. So promise keeping is secondary to the greater good for the greater number. In a third case, which we find hard but gets closer to home, is in Smead's book, Choices. It's about a bunch of spelunkers, people that like to go down in caves. They go down in the cave, there's a cave in, there are 6 of them, one of them is caught. There's only air to preserve them for 24 hours, but they happen to have a couple of sticks of dynamite. They can blow a hole through, and this is a given in this dilemma, they can blow a hole through, and chances are, sure, it might fall in, but you know, the chances, they don't have any other chance. They can blow this hole open, and 5 of them could escape, but the one person who's trapped is surely going to die. It seems like the greater good would be put those sticks of dynamite in there, so 5 can survive while one is lost. Now, again, this is a gut feeling we have. Something isn't right about that. You know, there's just seems to be something more should be asked here. I mean, at least you'd consult the guy who's caught. It's to whether or not he wants to go along with that. So there's just this feeling that there's a problem with this. And so another school of utilitarianism developed called rule utilitarianism. And so instead of justifying acts based on consequences or the greatest good, they justify rules as guides of action based on consequences. So an action is morally wrong if the consequences of performing it are generally undesirable. Examples: if everybody didn't pay their taxes, if all kinds of people started shortcutting switchbacks, if everybody started jaywalking across the streets instead of crossing at the corner with the light. It's this thing we talked about earlier about what happens if everybody did it. And you'll notice that this is a negative kind of decision. It's if things, the bad consequences that would happen if people did not generally follow a certain rule. So rules are justified when they are rules that would maximize utility if there were general acceptance of and conformity to them. The conformity of an act to a socially valuable rule makes the action right, whereas for the act utilitarian, the beneficial consequences of the act alone make it right or wrong. So it's rules we are deciding upon. Okay? But there still are problems, because the rule utilitarian ends up in a situation not unlike the deontologist. We get all these rules that are socially valuable rules, but what happens in a particular situation when those rules conflict? How do we decide which rule to go by? Well, people say, well, you just look at the consequences of following this rule or that rule. And then people say, well, wait a minute, if utility only determines which rule you follow, then aren't you really collapsing rule utilitarianism ultimately back into act utilitarianism? That it, in any given situation, utility ultimately decides what you do, and then you're thrown back again on the counterexamples that we had before. Now, I think there's some important criticisms of utilitarianism, that we've actually had some demonstrations of it already today, and that's that, you know, the calculus of utilitarianism is so incredibly complex, and the assumption of benevolence is in the extreme. Assuming that an individual can stand outside of a situation as a disinterested observer and unbiasedly determine Georgine's interests in this and Ed's interests in this, you know, I'm going to decide for you what these are, it gets to be really complex. Therefore, it is interesting that the kinds of situations in which this is used the most are policy-making decisions where a committee can be formed, can sit down and look at the costs, the benefits, and ideally, if you have representatives of all of the interests who can represent themselves rather than having somebody else represent for them, you can then maybe come to some kind of consensus. And I think I understand why it takes so doggone long for some of these things to take time. Why does it take so long for a nuclear power plant to be built or closed down, or a dam to be built or closed down? There's so many interests that have a stake in what's going to happen. And how do you reach consensus? But as a guide to action for every day, it gets pretty complex. And then Smeads raises, I think, some interesting questions. Do we really know what's good for people? What constitutes their happiness? Or even if reduced to the satisfaction of desires, what about morally unacceptable desires? Do I count those the same as anybody else's, unbiasedly? I mean, if it happens that what you like to do is kill dogs, pet dogs and cats, and that really turns you on, and that you get a lot of, you know, that really makes you feel good, do I count that desire as much as somebody who would rather collect dogs and cats and take them down and have them spayed and neutered so other people can have them? Are those equal? Seems a little bit strange. Now, utilitarians try to deal with that by saying we only count rational desires, but then we get to the problem you're pointing out. Who defines what are rational desires? And then do we really know which goods are better than others? This gets back to Mill's thing. And it's sort of collapsed, of course, by this idea of just desires, but if we're going to go by goods, who defines which goods are better than others? And then we have the problem, whose goods matter most? Your good, my good, the majority's good, the good of poor people? And then I think the most difficult thing of all for utilitarians is, do we really know when people should get their goods? These good results. Should it be right now? Should it be soon? Or sometime later? When you look at something in the short term, it might look really good. But in the long term, it might not look so good after all. We can have some of this in just looking at suntanning. You know, all the people that rush down to get suntan, I like to be suntan. Looks great. Looks a lot better than being a pale white face walking around. But that short-term benefit may have profound long-term consequences, not just for me, but for my family, should I be stricken with melanoma, for society, if I don't have my own health insurance, even if I have my own health insurance, you know, other things may happen. So, you know, when I look at this, how do I weigh this? Is the present benefit better than the possibility of later problems? So there are those four concerns that Smeads raises. But I think we have to face the fact that a lot of us do a kind of utilitarian calculus a lot of the time anyway. I mean, we do the best we can. We have a situation in front of us and we sort of say, well, if I do this, it's going to hurt Sam over there. If I do that, my mother isn't going to like it there, but my dad may think that's great. And so, you know, we kind of do it in a shortened version. So we shouldn't sort of say, well, this is obviously ridiculous, because we do use a part of it. And also to recognize that it has dominated our public life as the principal philosophy for determining just actions for most of our lives here. Though it is now, of course, coming into question by liberals of various sorts, basically John Rawls and Robert Nozick, who is a libertarian, and then also by others now, the Roman Catholic bishop's statement about the economy, and others who see communitarian values, Marxists, of course, as being more important than individual values. So there is utilitarianism. Tuesday, we looked at Kant. Using these various theories, can we go back to our dilemmas, back to the question of the Indian reservation, and can we formulate? You know, Matt, this is sort of role play. Imagine yourself, Immanuel Kant, you're in this situation. Can you structure a rule that rational people would accept as a universal law upon which to act in this situation? Maybe this is more a rhetorical question, because this would be like homework or something if you wanted to do it, but I want it more to be play, because I don't want to put people on the spot. Likewise then, imagine yourself a utilitarian, an act utilitarian and a rule utilitarian, and see what kinds of things you might come up with, and then try to think of counterexamples that might show a weakness there. Yes.
May I suggest some things? I live in New Mexico.
Yeah.
They have just, you know, given some reservation land to the Indians. Okay, you have to think. These are not the Indians we did the harm to. These are their descendants. They are, on the whole, and I have not studied this, please, this is just my own bias, not an appealing people. You know, they're into alcohol and drugs. And money will go very rapidly. It won't go for a new home or all the things we white people suspect will happen. I doubt that a great deal of it will. I find that in the state of New Mexico, many people are part Indian, you understand, and I I think I've studied it, but since I've been there, I see in the government much more, well, even in the Indian government, they've been having a big fuss down there with one of the Indians that was on the council, took some money, didn't belong to them and things, and so they're not doing too well. And I mean, to me, this might have a bearing on it if you were around that situation, how you would feel about what you did for the Indians.
Okay. Which might raise some issues again about retributive justice.
Right. How do we undo the damage that has been done is what I see.
And who is to bear the cost of that undoing of the damage?
Just giving them money isn't going to undo the damage that's been done.
How do you undo that damage then when you have missed it?
Well, the problems that Margaret was referring to, alcoholism and drug abuse and so on, we have to examine the root causes of those, and at some point we have to acknowledge that they've been the result of having had not only way of life taken from them, but all forms of livelihood, I mean, just practically speaking, that would bring them some kind of stability. So all of these signs, we call them social ills and so on, I mean, they really have to be examined before we could suggest how reparations would be made. And again, it's as if we could decide for them, which I have huge problems with.
Mm-hmm. How could you reconstitute the Sioux Nation of all the various tribes and allow the buffalo again to run so that the traditional family structures and religions could be reinstituted?
Because we, through our government, have just made a decision on this dilemma relative to the Japanese that we stole land from, mm-hmm. and displaced to internment camps. We didn't do that to Italians and Germans, remember, mm-hmm. only Japanese, during the Second World War. And we have paid the survivors, mm-hmm. and the relatives, a stipend. I don't think to benefit them. I think to try and clear our national conscience. Mm-hmm. And it's exactly a parallel case.
Except the question I have, Dick, is then with Native Americans and the culture that is really in contradiction in some ways with our own culture, as opposed to many of the Japanese American families who have been able to integrate their way of life into a market economy. Mm. How do you go back and try to bring back the dignity of tribal life and sharing? A lot of the problems with money, as I understand, has to do with sharing and things like that when everybody owns things sort of in common, and you have a way of life that supports that, and to participate in the market economy in some ways is disruptive of the very culture and the values that give you the dignity of being who you are.
There are tribes that have achieved that, or yes. are achieving that, the Yakimas, the
Warm Springs. Yeah. Right. That's right. And how,
but yes. that's only because by accident we gave them better land than we thought we had.
Like some of the Choctaw Indians in Oklahoma, we threw them off the good land in order to have the land rush in 1889, stuck them in this awful part of the state. It was terrible, but it turned out that's where all the oil was. So.
I heard a lecture from someone talking about some of the problems in New Mexico from the Indian's viewpoint. And they were complaining about how we came and put fences in land and literally would fence off the grazing area from the waterhole and did things to the poor, living off the subsistence land that the Indians had, they were making decisions that literally destroyed the little bit they had, taking them and giving them a lump sum payment to move into a house in white man's land in the city, then exploiting them to American bankers and so forth, and things that they were not used to, so that very soon the house they had been given was mortgaged, and they lost it, and they were back destitute and alcoholic, unemployed, etc. And that what the Indians wanted was to get their land back and not have these legal and physical separations to their grazing rights, and they wanted the coal-burning things in the Four Corners area out of there, which they felt were destroying their own health and their animal health. So I'll just throw that at the other viewpoint from the Indians.
Okay, listening to this conversation, and it seems to me there's general consensus that there's a deep problem here. So the challenge for all of us is, how do you develop rules, systems, philosophy, good reasons to get people to accept what you believe is right? And if people don't do that, then the dominant view is going to remain. You have to come up with good reasons when you are on the defensive to be able to put the other guy on the defensive. We can emote a lot, but to be able to change things, we have to also be able to think. And then how can you create consensus? If some of it is based on our own Christian values, how does that translate into a society which is a secular society? And can we expect people simply to accept it because God says it's so, when they don't believe in our God, or the way we believe in God? In that case, if they're Jewish, they have different way of understanding the same God. For that matter, Muslims, same God, different ways of understanding. How do you translate that into something that is acceptable by, in this sense, all rational people, when there is obvious moral disagreement here? And it's not a simple issue. Part of my problem with the church on moral issues tends to be our self-righteousness and our lack of considering the complexities of some of these issues and speaking too soon. I was quite impressed with the Roman Catholics myself. I mean, they went through 3 drafts of that document, and they took testimony and counter-testimony and all of that stuff to work it through. Too often I see in congregations and stuff, clergy stand up and start railing at the congregation about how you ought to be there and care about the Indians, and if you don't care about the Indians, you're not a Christian. Well, what do you do dealing with the fact that there are good Christians who believe differently than you do? And can you simply do that without giving good reasons to your congregation as to why, and recognizing that maybe you're wrong? This is a part, again, we were talking about this last night, about living with contraries. I mean, part of being a moral person right now in our day and age is humility. Being able to act in the midst of ambiguity, where, in fact, you may be wrong. Why? Because you may have the facts wrong. Or there may be consequences of your rule that you haven't thought about that are pretty destructive. So it takes a lot of humility and a lot of work, a lot of moral imagination, to be able to open yourself up to the best arguments of your opponents. Their best arguments, not their weak arguments, not some sort of straw character that you can easily knock down, but what are their best arguments for their own position and against yours? And can you take them seriously and treat them as equals? Can we live with diversity in the church and accept it? I know there are congregations up in northern Minnesota to which these farming families belong that have a difficult time. Let's take another situation that was even more difficult, and that was the Hormel strike down in Austin, Minnesota. And the issue of justice there and all of that, that divided the community terribly. Now, how in the midst of that can the church speak the truth with love and still be a reconciling community, accepting people whose position differs? I'm an Episcopalian. George Bush is an Episcopalian. Cap Weinberger is an Episcopalian. There were all of these people who have very different views than I do, but am I to assume that somehow I'm a better Christian than they are? And that their position is wrong and mine is obviously right? No, I've got to be able to sit down and look at their arguments and their position and answer it point for point and come up with better arguments. And then face the fact in the end that we're probably not going to agree. And how do we love one another in the midst of this wider community, knowing that the truth is greater than us, and that we have to therefore fight with each other? I mean, we're going to fight in the sense of political fighting, but in God's eyes, we are still sinners and saved together. I think that's the real challenge. I'd like to leave off here, because some of you, I know you can't come again. Some of you came last time, and this is a repeat. But Lewis Smedes, in his book Choices, gives sort of five quick little list of things to do when making moral decisions that I think is excellent. It's not complex. It wouldn't probably stand up if we went into all kinds of technical things, but for like a rule of thumb, I suggest these. And these are: face facts. That's the beginning thing. Face facts. Second thing, respect rules. What are the rules in this situation? Are there any rules? What are the rules? Consider the consequences. Be responsible, that is, have character in order to be able to follow through on this, and if you're wrong, be able to admit you're wrong. And then his fifth one is something that is for us who are part of a religious community, and the Christian community in particular, and that is trust God and God's forgiveness, because it's better to act faithfully and be wrong than to not act at all out of fear of being wrong. So I close with that, and then we can continue our conversation, and next time we're going to talk about, in a sense, a totally different thing that seems very antiquated. It's all about virtue and character. Aristotle, Aquinas, which was the dominant view of moral theology all the way up until the Enlightenment, and even past that, and is coming back again today because we are recognizing that simply to know the right thing to do does not always ensure that people have the gumption and the courage to do the right thing.
Will you repeat those again? Moral
decisions? Face facts. Respect rules. This guy's got to be a Presbyterian. I was always taught you to create these alliterations here on your points. Face facts. Respect rules, consider consequences, and then be responsible, trust God.
Thank you.
Again, I recommend his book. For some reason, Harper and Row keeps it in hardback. I don't know why. It's a wonderful little book for people who haven't got a whole lot of time to go into all the technical discussions of a textbook in ethics. It's, I think, wonderfully written.
Can I
yes, really.
One
sure.
Idea.
Sure.
My heart, through this neat discussion, comes back to us as people praying for a new Pentecost. Because I saw a miniature one happen in Budapest. We have an international conference every 7 years. 99 countries come. Only 1,200 representatives from 60 million Lutherans. It looked like the Politburo when they began operating, all male. And all of a sudden, somebody brought up, shouldn't we make this equal? And here they were from countries, Muslim, you know, Hong Kong, New Guinea, you name it, Japan. All of a sudden, they made a decision. They have 40% women, 40% men, in all their categories, all their invited delegates. And there are only a few of them, 1,200 from, you know. And they voted that, plus the 40% would be you got a 40% left, would be divided proportionately depending upon considerations. But the mindset would be to be totally equal. And it passed by a male audience, just like that. Like you see in China, all of a sudden, the Lord effaces all the opposition, removes the tension, and they all agreed. These were, you know, I sat there. It was a Pentecost.
I just couldn't believe it. I'm glad that any reactionaries in the Lutheran Church don't have tanks and armies waiting in the background to squash.
And this was in Budapest, in a communist country.
Yes.
But in a religious setting. So I'll tell you another one. We wanted to change the bylaws of the country club I belong to so that women's name would be on the stock certificate. There's a board of 9 guys, 10 guys. No way. No way. Oh, the complications of having a woman's name along with yours on a stock certificate. Well, it's on your stock certificate if you're AT&T, isn't it? Yeah, but that's different.
a non-religious setting and just a crazy old board meeting, you know. But.
Yeah.
Grant, let me share something with all of you. That I find it so remarkable that my career, which is responsibility to you, the owners of the National Forest, is almost always relevant to every discussion that happens that I get involved in Holden. This one is classic. You might know this, but I bet you don't. Here is the utilitarian direction that the Forest Service received to manage the National Forest for the people of the United States in 1905. It came from the Assistant Secretary to Gifford Pinchot. And it says, it's a single letter, and I have a copy of it. And it says, all decisions in the management of the National Forest shall be made in terms of the greatest good for the greatest number in the long run. It's all three elements.
That's right.
And that has dominated the direction of decision making in the National Forest. Since 1905. And if you don't think we run into dilemmas to try and make the spirit of that direction come true, I can give you pages of real life dilemmas in trying to achieve, you know, a response to that direction. The greatest good for the greatest number in the long run.
Yeah.
So you've got a whole government agency that operates under utilitarian approach.
Yeah. And is there anything wrong with that? Can we, you know, that's.
We've often looked at what contrary direction might have produced.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I need to have back the dilemmas, and I do have this bibliography if anybody wants to do a little reading. Unfortunately, you know, none of these books are in the library except Karen LeBach's book on 6 Theories of Justice, which we will be talking about on Saturday.